During the pandemic, much has been written about the increased popularity of CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture. On this week's Special Sauce, we had a far-reaching conversation with Maggie Janey, one of the owners of Rocksteady Farm, which is part of a special kind of CSA. Rocksteady describes itself as a women and queer-owned cooperative farm, rooted in social justice, growing sustainable vegetables, flowers, and herbs for our upstate and New York City communities. As you will hear, Maggie and her partners have withstood the many challenges they have encountered during the pandemic with sheer determination, a lot of hard work, and support both financial and otherwise from the communities they serve. But it has not been easy. Rounding out the episode is another Ask Kenji segment. This time, Kenji answers a serious eater's question about the whys and wherefores of salting vegetables like cucumbers and eggplant before cooking them. I don't want to give away too much of his answer, but I will tell you that water balloons are repeatedly mentioned. But first, serious eaters, meet the extraordinary Maggie Janey.
So first of all, tell us who you are and what you do.
So my name is Maggie Cheney. I am one of the co-owners and vegetable farmers at Rocksteady Farm. So Rocksteady is a LGBTQ owned and operated farm. We've been around for 5 years, so we're still pretty infant farm when it comes to a lot of other farms. We're babies. We grow sustainable vegetables for a 380-person CSA in New York City as well as upstate. We also have creative partnerships with nonprofits, food pantries, and health clinics so that we're serving lower-income people as well as HIV/AIDS people in New York City. And we also sell wholesale to large-scale restaurant groups. We are also in a lot of intentional kind of community building within our own staff and trying to create a space where, you know, LGBTQ people can come from all over the country and feel like they can be themselves in a workplace. And I think that that's that mission work of centering the farmer is something we're really intentional about and lean in into more and more so that we're not just constantly thinking about the consumer, but also what are opportunities for each other and the cooperative model built that way so that there can be a lot of professional development and skill building.
And you have a sliding scale, right? You have people that don't pay anything for their CSA boxes, right?
Yes. Yeah, we have a sliding scale that's made possible through, you know, higher income consumers paying more for their boxes, and that offsets the boxes for lower income people. So there's that, as well as we receive donations through a fiscal sponsorship so that we can get 501c3 grants and individual donations. And that goes into a food access fund and allows us to give fully subsidized shares to even broader amount of people. So some of our sites are completely subsidized and some of them are partially.
Can you sort of give me a succinct explanation of how CSAs work? I know, but it'd be great for Special Sauce listeners to understand.
Yeah. So Community Supported Agriculture, CSA, the more traditional kind of like understanding of it is that there's an upfront commitment from the consumer to receive weekly vegetables for 20 to 30 weeks, depending. And that relationship is built on mutual trust where, you know, the consumer pays the farmer either all up front. And so there's like a trust, like, okay, I'm going to trust you with my money and I'm going to trust that you're going to deliver every week. And then also there's like different models like ours where we have payment plans, you know, so there's ways that you can get paid monthly, but there's still that commitment. There's still a kind of signed contract that, you know, you can trust that we're going to sign up and receive your food all year round. And what they receive on their end is weekly a box of vegetables and fruit. Sometimes there's eggs and meat. We do a full diet CSA. So we collaborate with other farmers who provide the eggs, meat, cheese, yogurt. And they usually get, you know, depending on the size box, they can get 6 items, diversified items in their box, or like 8 to 10 items if a larger share. And what's great is that it's up to the farmer traditionally what goes in those boxes. So it's very farmer friendly in that way. So that if we have a crop loss in the field of radishes, we can substitute for the next best looking thing in the field and cater the box each week. And there's a lot of different takes on that model. There's some that each customer picks and chooses every single item in the box. But the general theme of it is commitment for a whole season of produce, and the farmer chooses what goes in those weekly shares.
And you were practically born into this CSA or farm to table movement, right? Like, tell us, like, your dad was involved, right? Tell us about the Cheney family and how you all got involved in this stuff.
So my dad is still involved. He's a farmer through and through. And I did grow up farming on and off since I was a baby. I remember, you know, just hanging out in the fields and like spending most of my childhood wandering around, tagging along with everyone else, and then eventually being old enough to do tasks and weeding projects and then full-time jobs in the summertime and stuff. But my dad founded and co-founded a project called the Food Project outside Boston. So that was a CSA farm, but also very much a nonprofit farm that integrated food justice work and education, job training programs for high school youth in Boston, as well as the outside kind of surrounding towns. So I grew up, you know, in the world of not just farming, but I think social justice lends to farming. And currently my dad is working at a larger scale farm than I am. I'm at 13 acres and he's at 200 plus acres doing mostly tractor work and production for a large farm outside Boston right now.
So really, truly, and this pun is just too luscious for me to ignore, the apple didn't fall far from the tree.
Correct. Yeah, there are definitely lots of similarities, my dad and I. Yeah.
Did you fall in love with farming and what your dad was doing right away? Or did you arrive at it, you know, through a more circuitous path?
I think I never thought I would be a farmer when I was growing up. You know, I really thought I would go more into teaching. I was really passionate about special education. I grew up in the special ed system and wanted to work with kids. But as soon as I started doing that, I really got antsy and wanted to be outside and kept getting drawn to outdoor work. And also just felt really powerless when it came to, you know, being in school systems where the food was so horrific and seeing that happen to so many different youth in different cities and different parts of the country where the food that they were eating was impacting them so greatly in their academics and their access at home, and just seeing that firsthand, especially in the special ed community, I just knew that probably the most impact I could do is by growing food and trying to get creative around food access and connecting a really broad group of people to fresh food and organically grown food as best as I could. So that's what I continue to weave kind of education and farming throughout my life. And now I'm in my late 30s, so I've been doing it since I was a kid.
And that, you even went to school in it, right?
I did do a program at UC Santa Cruz. It was there for 2 years. It's a certificate program in sustainable agriculture. Mm-hmm.
And so tell us about Rocksteady Farm and tell us about your history of dealing with CSAs.
Sure. So I'd worked on a number of CSAs throughout my life, and my dad ran another CSA farm, Linden Tree Farm, outside Boston as well. So I had familiarity with it. And then when my co-founding team, Angela and Dee and I, started Rocksteady 5 years ago, we actually took it over from a previous farm. And we converted into a cooperative farm with a more justice-based mission, but we continued the CSA model that the previous farmer had when we did the transfer of ownership. And then we expanded the CSA from there. So that was definitely a core piece to how we wanted to farm. There's a lot in the CSA that appealed to us as farmers, but definitely a different style of CSA farming than I think a lot of farms in the States and country actually, and or in the world have. And I think that's because we're going at an angle that we're not just trying to cater to the people who can afford that upfront cost. We're trying to cater to a really broad group of people. So we have a sliding scale to our CSA. And right now, 55% of all of our food goes to lower income people in the Hudson Valley and in New York City. And then we also have close partnerships with a lot of community organizations, health centers in New York City that serve HIV/AIDS patients, LGBTQ community. You know, we work with food pantries upstate. So the CSA model is applied to these partnerships in a new way. So we kind of cater each of those partnerships a little differently. But I mean, big picture, rock steady, we're doing a lot, but we're an incredible group. You know, I'm just one farmer out of all of us. We're a group of 9 total, and we're a social justice farm run and owned and operated by LGBTQ community. And we serve primarily that community as well. We're certified or non-certified organic, so we're sustainably growing food. And we do both CSA and wholesale. So we do have some connects to some great restaurant groups in New York City that keep us going in another direction. But this year in COVID, it's been really helpful to have the CSA model because of the restaurant decline.
Right. So tell us about when the pandemic hit. What happened to your business? What happened to your employees? What happened?
Yeah. I mean, it feels so long ago at this point, March.
I know.
So much has happened since then. But it was a really stressful time. It was really scary as a business owner to have something like a global pandemic happen. And
yeah,
our concerns were first and foremost with our staff. And that meant, you know, quarantining people as they joined in April. We had delays from some of our farmers who were, you know, coming from out of state. They were caught up quarantining in different locations. There was a whole kind of revamping of all of our hygiene and safety protocols, cleaning protocols, so that we could, you know, address the needs of the farmers right then and there, because unlike a lot of other businesses, we're essential workers and nothing stopped. We didn't take one day off. So we had to pivot and adjust and build all these new systems, you know, within hours of the new kind of quarantine, you know, legislation that was coming out. So that took a lot in and of itself. And then also in that, there were so many unknowns about what was going to happen. And we had to do a lot of, we basically redid our entire budget. We reconfigured all of our outlets. We expanded our CSA. We dropped wholesale. We, you know, added different CSA partners, did tons of communication with our partners in New York City, because New York City was the epicenter. We've now box all of our shares instead of the more kind of farmers market style bulk bins that people choose from. And within all of that, we were dealing with the financial implications of it on the back end. So not only all this time and labor spent that where we were multiple people in the office navigating these changes, but and not in the field. So there's that stress on the farm, but also kind of, you know, applying for the PPP, applying for SBA loans on top of the farming. It was absolutely ridiculous. You know, it was a lot of work and incredibly stressful, but very, very grateful that we were able to throw down and we did get support. And I think, you know, that was really made possible through, you know, networks of farmers in the Hudson Valley who were communicating with each other with listservs and Zooms and technical support. But also, as a cooperative, we have technical support with another whole world out there who is providing technical support for not farmers, but other small businesses. And I really feel like because we were receiving those two, we were able to actually get the PPP and apply for those and know kind of like the nature of the rolling and, you know, bank connections, as well as receive information from other farmers about their practices and pivots that they were doing. But that has not been the case for a lot of farmers who didn't have both of those kind of support networks.
You know, one of the things that I found in talking to a lot of farmers and chefs and restaurateurs and purveyors is that people talk about something that most people don't realize is what you just described is you basically had to pivot to a new business model while you're going full bore and trying to survive.
On very slim margins. Yeah.
Right. With slim margins to begin with. And now you're all of a sudden you're in new businesses. Your restaurant business, I assume, just fell off a cliff, right? You had to, you know, it was just, and who knows how much of it will come back. But did you manage to keep all of your employees employed?
Yeah, that was our number one priority, is no matter what, we weren't cutting hours, so we would do whatever it took. And I think because we were a CSA model, we could do that because of the nature of that type of income stream that comes in the beginning of the year, which was right along the same time that this whole pandemic hit, we had that cash flow. So even though all these other government supports were not yet known, we could still keep people on our payroll.
Got it. Yeah. So what do you think is going to happen short term to not only Rocksteady, but CSAs in general? And then what do you see sort of moving forward?
I do think short term, the CSA model for farmers who already had that in place and had the systems to take on members this year, I think they're doing really well. I think we're seeing a lot of learning in wholesale farms who are trying to make that shift and learning all the challenges of it. So for farmers who already were doing the CSA model, I think they're in a good place to continue that. But what we're seeing is a really big impact on wholesale farms and even farmers market farmers. It depends on the area. You know, those are challenged as well some places to make that shift to a diversified CSA box. And so there's learning that's happening, there's growing pains. And I do think that we're going to see a huge uptick in them next year because, you know, Corona's not going away. And you're going to see more people wanting to kind of do that model for their own consumption. And I do think that there will be an uptick. So the question is, okay, how do we support these farms to transition to that model successfully because the restaurants are going downhill? And how can we get really creative on two fronts in terms of like collaboration with other farms and aggregating so that if you're a spinach farmer, you don't have to then all of a sudden grow 60 different crops. Can you be working with other farms and using aggregation and delivery methods, which we're seeing in real time all over the country? And also, how do we make sure that that food that is now going into a CSA model is not just getting to the highest income bracket of the community? You know, can we teach this model of sliding scale? Can we redirect some of that produce also to a broader spectrum of people?
I mean, what's fascinating is that your work has always focused on this intersection of CSAs and social justice, which is a very unusual combination, right? Because we associate CSAs generally with people of privilege. It's incredibly exciting to see somebody tackling this problem, which is not a small problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big problem, and it probably requires people like yourself with a missionary mm-hmm. zeal. Do you think that there'll be labor shortages? Like, one of the things that Dan Barber is trying to do is connect out of work cooks with mm-hmm. farms. So they'll get closer to the food that they're mm-hmm. making. And so he imagines a young core of cooks turned farmers. What he was saying, and it doesn't sound like you are experiencing this, is that ultimately the pandemic is going to put so much pressure on so many farms that there are going to be labor shortages, and there are going to be costs associated with the pivoting that will make it difficult for many farms to sustain.
It's interesting. I mean, we're a small scale farm in an area that has a lot of small scale farms. You know, I think in many ways I'm in a bubble of like communication and kind of administrative support in this area. And I think, yeah, I don't really know how to answer that question. I think what came to mind when listening to you was, you know, who are those people that were employed by restaurants, and why are they the ones who are then going to do the farm work? And I think often because those are two of the lowest paying wage jobs in the country. And just noting that, that to me, okay, so there could be these shifts back and forth. And oftentimes if there are immigrant communities who were coming from other countries, they may have those farm skills, which is really valuable to then have shifting to the agricultural sector. And how can we uplift agricultural sector and kind of the restaurant world so that those jobs are valued in the way that they need to get valued, and that those are fair, you know, wages for those people, and that there are enough incentives for leadership and career development and all of these things. And not just, okay, let's displace one group of people to another group of people, but let's talk about actually what are the daily lives of those people, and how can we support that? And how can we support farms in general to start paying people what they deserve? That's the bigger issue to me. Yeah.
Right. For sure. No, I think you raise a really good point. Just because a cook who is making $18 an hour can work at a farm, to farm workers that are, I'm sure you're paying your farmers at least $15 an hour, you know, I assume.
Mean, we're barely there. A lot of farms don't pay $15 an hour. I mean, majority of farms are just above living wage, like state requirements. So at $12.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And $12 to $15 really isn't a living wage,
it's
right?
Not.
When you get,
yeah,
you know, and I guess that's what keeps you up at night.
Yeah. Very much so. I mean, we started our farm with no financial support of our own. We didn't have any of our own personal inherited wealth. So we each brought $500 to our farm, and we started Rocksteady on loans. And so we are right now in year five, you know, paying back large loans, trying to sustain our business and operations and buying supplies and pivot, you know, and added new supplies in a COVID year, but also trying to increase our wages for our employees every year as much as we can humanly possible do. But the margins are so tight because we don't have that padding. We don't have any safety net, except for our social safety net, which is huge, which we lean on. And that's, you know, part of our identity is to build community. But financially, it's really tight, and we're not alone. You know, we're not getting the subsidies that big farms get. We are barely making it. And 99% of all farms in the country exist because there are people who are working at the top who also have other jobs.
Right.
So, you know, they either have other jobs or they have inherited wealth, and that's how it works. But if you're trying to, you know, sustain a business as a business, the food system doesn't support that. it's in the prices of food haven't gone up, but the price of labor has gone up as it should.
So, and in a lot of ways, obviously the pandemic has just exacerbated a lot of the problems that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think about, you know, the way that urban community are fleeing the city right now and going to live in rural spaces. But what is that doing to housing access for farm labor in those rural spaces now that we have higher income people coming into our communities and taking up all the housing? You know, that's the, because we are of a low income group, you know, now we don't have any housing. So it's, this is, that's like just one micro example of kind of the disparities that exist within the food system that are now exacerbated.
These are really big problems you're wrestling with, but you sound pretty determined.
Yeah, I think I definitely am optimistic. I have to be, or else I wouldn't be doing this work. It's hard every day in so many different levels. You know, I'm optimistic because I think it's a shaking up of a system and it's a rebuilding moment. And I am very excited about, you know, coalition building and partnership building and thinking outside of the box and trying to address these regional and, you know, national issues, because we've seen, now everyone's seen the failures in a system that I've known has been failed for my whole life. And now people are like, okay, how do I address that? You know, I think it's a place for collaboration, which is what we need right now. And I think that there's opportunity in that in terms of, especially for, you know, LGBTQ community, like BIPOC community, the amount of organizing and support networks and mutual relief work that's going on all over the country. I mean, using that incredible energy and working it into different sectors of our society, you know, like where's the change that we need to see happen in the food system, given the systemic racism that we have seen? Where's the change that we have to see in education? Where's the change that we have to see in zoning and housing? And I think people are shifting, you know, like there's real shifts happening. And I think if there is that overlap with identity and movement building and trying to really, really support those communities that have been pushed to the side for so many years, I think that is what I'm hoping for. You know, I really, yeah. And I think, and those communities, we're resilient. The world needs to learn from us. You know, queer LGBTQ people, we've been resilient from existence for.
Yeah, because you've had no choice.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And I think there's a lot to be learned from these communities because we have such structures of support networks and resiliency that I think we need to be uplifting and continuing. So that's no different in the farming world.
They're sort of mirror images, right? The farming world and the other worlds that you're trying to merge, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the problems are some of the same. And it sounds like one way or another, you feel like as long as you get to the other side.
Yeah. We're definitely tackling the challenge every day. And I think what's important for anyone who's doing this type of work, regardless of, you know, what field you're in and what passion moves you, is that you're taking care of yourself while you do it, you know, and really thinking about self-care and, you know, healing during this time. I think, you know, farmers historically do not have self-care practices. It's bred into the farming culture to overwork, to work 75-hour weeks using heavy machinery that's incredibly dangerous, you know, pushing your body and your mind to the max. And that's just the expectation. And I think that there needs to be a shift in both the mentality of kind of farm work and self-care, but also in like in movement building and you know, fighting systemic racism and white supremacy. Like we, in both of those worlds, we need to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves, because I think there's so much risk at a time like this, even though there's, you know, these opportunities and ways, but it's also, it's very touch and go, you know, like each day it might feel impossible one day and possible the next day. And it's just, you know, getting through those days that it feels impossible and being able to wake up the next day and do it over again. And that's a real thing, you know, like the highest rates of suicide in our country are farmers. And that is, there's a lot of reasons for that. And to be doing this work, it's not easy.
No, it's you have not chosen an easy path, Maggie.
No. But, you know, those little things help a lot, you know, like just eating the food that you grow, which some farm workers aren't even able to do, but that's really meaningful. And then taking walks, resting, sleeping a lot, being in community as best you can in a COVID year. You know, those, I think because we saw that isolation this year, it made all those self-care goals a little harder. Yeah, that's just something that I think about a lot.
You regard the CSA movement can be part of the meaningful change you're trying to affect.
Yes. Yeah, it centers the farmers' needs, as you know, and I think that it doesn't center all consumers. It's not going to work for everyone. Like, and I definitely believe that all types of food distribution are important. But I think in a time like this, where people want direct farmer-consumer relationships that they can trust and that serve a purpose in their life, I think there's more people are more interested in CSA model. But I think the part of the CSA model that really works right now is the fact that it's good for farmers. The upfront, you know, money, that is a real important piece to farmer mental health and being able to, you know, go into a season and know that there could be a flood or a drought or a tornado and, okay, I still have money in the bank and I have, you know, and that is big. And I think the more that type of transparency and communication can get to the people who are eating that food, the better. And I think, you know, a lot of people don't understand the life of farming who are eating the food, because we live in a world where there are very few farmer consumer interactions. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what drives me also, is just like trying to build that understanding and communication with our community that we feed. And that's another way that we like the CSA model, is because we can talk to other people who eat our food.
Yeah. And what's fascinating about it also is that I don't think people understand, you know, I've done so many stories, you know, where I've spent 2 days at a farm. They don't understand just how precarious the life of a farmer is. You know, it's, you must exist on 4 hours of sleep a night.
Some do. Yeah. Some farmers do. That is definitely what I was talking before.
And the other thing that I noticed is, if you're dependent on farmers markets and you get torrential rain the day before, you don't have much.
No, it's a loss. You just lost $2,000 of product.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't think people really understand that. There's so many things that are out of control. It's not like someone's going to become like when people say, oh, but they're charging $25 a pound for greens. I said, that person that charges $25 a pound for those microgreens is not going to their house in the Hamptons by helicopter every weekend.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. I think every farm, you know, we don't choose our prices out of nowhere. You know, we choose it based on, you know, either market kind of comparisons at, you know, if you're at a farmer's market, but also just the cost that it takes to grow that product. And I think, you know, the wholesale market is really, really hard in that way. Dairy industry is really hard in that way, because farmers don't have a control of those wholesale prices that are set often at the kind of industrial scale. And, you know, you can get a lot more money per bunch at a farmer's market or CSA than we could trying to compete with 1,000-acre farms.
Right.
And I do think that, you know, there's, even though farming is something that has all these unknowns and has all these risks, inherently you're trying to do something with no predictability whatsoever. And you're working with nature, and nature is not predictable, and it's becoming more and more not predictable with climate change. And I think that, you know, for many farmers, just the act of farming and the kind of the brain and skill and passion for it is what keeps them going. You know, it's like people could be doing all these other things with their time and getting paid way more, but there's a real beauty in the actual like work itself and how diverse it is and being outside and being physical with your body. And unfortunately, it just doesn't give you the amount of money that you need. And so therefore, you know, causes that stress every day that you wish didn't exist. But the actual active farming is incredibly enjoyable for a lot of people, I think.
Do you think that CSAs, whether, you know, it's during the pandemic or after the pandemic, are they scalable? Is the idea of a CSA scalable? It's not that, I'm sure you're not trying to replace grocery stores, you know, but is it scalable at least on some level?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's where you get into collaborative models where, you know, larger scale farms are growing certain crops for the CSA and then an entity is aggregating those and boxing them. And I think that there is a, you know, in California, there are some CSAs that are 8,000 members, you know, and that's been happening for years pre-COVID, you know, and that works. That is a scalable model. I think the food system itself needs to scale up in every way. You know, food is critical for everyone. So figuring out what is the farmer-friendly version to do that is great, you know, and I think not every farm has a capability of delivering door-to-door, but maybe they can, you know, many farms can do a couple hundred shares and then deliver it to a drop-off point that some other entity could deliver it door-to-door for them. So I think there are these creative ways, but I do think it's scalable.
And it sounds like that the key to not only surviving during COVID, but in general, is this collaborative effort between farms, right? And without that, it doesn't sound like it would work.
No, I think collaboration is key. Yeah. And I think with climate change, it's key. People, you know, farmers are having to adjust and learn from each other and take guidance from farmers who have been doing this much longer and trying new techniques. I think that's key. And we're looking to other farmers who are, you know, more experienced than us to look at their practices and learn from them before we trial them. You know, I think you're, as a farmer, and especially if there are people who are new to farming, you need as much support as you can get to exist. It's a very hard business. So I think that in and of itself, and I think that that's also a cool thing around, you know, bridge building in rural locations. I think because farming is so collaborative and a lot of farmers lean on each other for use of tractors, equipment, sales, I think that there's some really interesting bridge building between, you know, us as LGBTQ people and the farmer next door who is a Republican who has very different politics from us, but we still want to share the same equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting thing, I think, now in the time of like leading up to the election, you know, where it can be very, very heightened in rural areas leading up to such a polarized election. But these, you know, little collaborations along those political lines are great. Yeah. And interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much, Maggie, for sharing your special sauce with us. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
And we'll talk soon. 'Kay. Thanks a lot.
Have a great one.
All right. Now it's time for our question of the week that people send in for our chief culinary consultant, author of The Food Lab, Mr. Kenji Lopez Alt. Our question of the week comes from Kim Edge, who is wondering, salting squash, eggplant, cucumbers, in each case they draw off liquid, but then the salt gets washed off with water. How does the water not get reabsorbed again during this process?
Okay, so you're talking about, so when you want to reduce the moisture content of,
right.
Yeah, the eggplant, you salt it and then you wash it off, and then when you fry it, it fries a lot better because not as much moisture comes out, or when you roast it, et cetera.
Right.
So the reason that works is because plants are made of cells, right, which are sort of like little teeny set, like water balloons that are kind of glued together. They're all filled with mostly water and, you know, a bunch of other whatever little things, little organs and stuff, all the other stuff the cell that plant cells have in them. Mostly water though, and so what happens is when you salt a vegetable, the osmosis ends up pulling that water out. So osmosis is the force that pulls a liquid from an area of low solute concentrate to high solute concentrate. So when you salt the outside of a vegetable, you create an area of very, 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 very highly saturated water, and then that pulls water from inside the cells out across the cell membrane. And so, yeah, the salt is what's drawing the water out of the cell membrane. You know, that's an active force that's pulling the water out. There's nothing that's going to push the water back in. There's no real force that's going to push the water back in other than diffusion, you know, and diffusion is kind of something that happens back and forth across the membrane as opposed to a directional thing. It's very similar to think about it like literally as water balloons. If you put a little pinprick in a water balloon and squeeze some of the water out of it like that, it's very easy to get the water out. But then if you take that same balloon and you know, pour a bucket of water over it, it's not like the water is going to go back in through that pinprick because there's nothing pushing the water back in. So that's really the answer. It's because basically there's no force that's pushing the water back into those cells. And also it's like, you know, it's really just that a vegetable is not a sponge. A vegetable is more like a series of water balloons as opposed to a sponge.
So how does that explanation affect water balloon fights?
I don't know. You need four. I don't know. Stand by the hose.
All right. I think Kim's in good shape, Kenji, and so is her squash and her eggplant and her cucumbers. So we'll talk to you next week.
So there you have it, our very first all-vegetable special sauce that is inspiring, surprising, and informative. Please stay safe and healthy, serious eaters, and I hope you don't mind me reminding you yet again that the pandemic dictates that we should do everything we can at this perilous moment to support both local restaurants like Kenji's Wursthal in San Mateo, California, and farmers like Maggie Cheney. So long, serious eaters. We'll see you next time.